The government here has obviously been seeking a ceasefire before talks because it's clearly in their interest, in whatever way they can, try to halt the rebel advances.
William Wallace in the capital, Kinshasa. Out in the field, meanwhile, the rebels' advance has been quickening. They're closing in on the country's second city, Lubumbashi, in a region rich in mineral deposits. Reports say they're using the train system to speed their advance. The BBC's David Bamford is in Lubumbashi. Where are the rebels?
Latest reports put them roughly about 300 kilometres from the northeast. That's around Lake Mweru area, and from there they can come down by river another 100 kilometres, and then there's about 200 kilometres of road. And we're getting reports from the northwest that they are in control of several trains, and they're using the railway system to move from that direction. And according to some reports, they're as close as 200 kilometres, which would put them perhaps only a few hours away were they to move on the town very quickly. But some suspect they'll take their time overtaking the area.
Are they likely to meet stiff resistance from the presidential guard or the regular government forces?
Well, always difficult to predict these things, but by all accounts, that's not going to be the case. According to expatriate sources that live here in the town, the arrangement is that there's not going to be any big fight against the rebels. As far as the local soldiers are concerned, many of them are local boys. It's suspected that many of them may even support the rebel movement. They're not likely to put up a fight. The presidential guard, well, that's another matter. They may deal with the rebels in some way, but the probability is that they won't put up a fight either. They will accept the inevitable.
What's the feeling of the people in the town about the rebels moving on it?
Well, it has to be said that most of the local population, most of the civilian population, seem to support the rebels, seem to support Laurent Kabila. He is a local man. He did originate from Shaba province. And they're waiting for the rebels to arrive and change their lives.
David Bamford in Lubumbashi. And you're listening to Newsday in the World Service of the BBC. The US Vice President Al Gore is in Beijing for talks with the leadership, which he's promised will include the touchy subject of human rights. They'll also cover the bilateral business relationship, and deals involving American giants Boeing and General Motors have been signed with Mr. Gore in attendance. He himself has spoken of his talks with Prime Minister Li Peng as productive. When I spoke to our correspondent in Beijing, Carrie Gracie, I suggested these deals must bind the two countries closer together.
Indeed, and I think that's obviously the hope of the Chinese side, that putting these deals on the table now will give the outside world, and particularly the American public, the impression that relations with China are useful and important to the United States.
And is there also a feeling that the US administration, and Mr. Gore in particular, may play tough in negotiations over favored trading nation status so as to appear not to have been bought by the campaign donations, if such there were?
I think they may choose to appear so, but I think the Chinese will see through that very readily. For many years now, this MFN status, most favored nation status, has appeared to be up for dispute every year, but every year it's gone through, and I think the Chinese regard it as an irritating piece of theatre rather than a real thing in doubt.
If that's an irritating piece of theatre, how do they regard Mr. Gore's pledge to raise the issue of human rights again?
As the same, I think. The American administration in this second Clinton term has said that the relationship with China cannot be held hostage to one issue. I think a clear indication that human rights, although they will be raised on each of these high-level visits to Beijing, that they will not be central or be the focus beyond which everything else falls or stands. I think that the other issues, the trade relationship, the defense relationship, etc., are important, and those are all the view of the United States now, is that the relationship has to go forward on all fronts and can't be held hostage to human rights alone.
So where does the balance now lie then? There is a clear desire on both sides, it seems, to improve the relationship. Indeed, it already is getting. And yet there are these two sticking points, most favoured nation and human rights.
Well, that's right. I think that though that both of those will go forward, the discussions will continue. I mean, obviously, the particular concern of the U.S. administration is this spiraling trade deficit with China. So I think the trade issue is perhaps the most serious for them.
Carrie Gracie in Beijing. European Union foreign ministers are set to meet the foreign and prime minister of Albania in Rome today, though it's not clear whether any new EU proposals will emerge to deal with the insurgency. In one bilateral development, it's now been arranged that Italy will patrol the entire Adriatic in a bid to halt the flow of refugees to Brindisi. Italy has also begun delivering humanitarian aid both to the capital Tirana and the southern port of Vlora, which Peter Biles has visited to see whether conditions there have improved.
In the centre of Vlora, Ghani Ibrahimi is clearing up broken glass and boarding up his small clothes shop. It was looted in the recent violence. He says he's lost everything, and he blames the Albanian president, Sali Berisha, for his plight.
It's Berisha's fault. I'll crush his head like this. I'll crush his head and nail him down like I'm doing with this.
Unë mendoj se më keq mund të bëhet. Nuk I kemi besim.
I have no trust in anyone now. No trust left.
Pa lek nuk ka demokraci.
Without money, there is no democracy. Without any capital and investments, there is no democracy. So we want back our money.
The port of Vlora is virtually deserted. The water laps gently against the quayside. There are no more boats preparing to cross the Adriatic to Italy. Those that were here have gone. But a few people are waiting around in the vain hope that they too can flee Albania. People are starving here, says this 59-year-old man. They don't have any money. For those of us who are retired, there's no hope at all. People are frightened and terrified at night. There's a lot of looting, and the television reports killings all the time, he says. The sound of gunfire echoes across Vlora with ominous regularity, and in the main hospital, a 10-year-old boy lies in the intensive care unit, one of the latest victims of the violence.
Yes, my uncle has a shop, and I was staying in the shop, and they came to steal in the shop, and I wouldn't let them, and they fired at me. People came to steal, and they fired.
So amid the bloodshed, the confusion, and the anger, who controls Vlora now? A police battalion is promised, but only a handful of police patrol the streets, uncertain of whether they have public support. People's hopes rest with the recently established local Salvation Committee. The members say they'll cooperate with the new interim coalition government in Tirana, but they're still demanding the resignation of President Berisha. The chairman of the Vlora Committee, the suavely dressed Albert Schitti, predicts what would seem to be impossible. He says that people who lost money in the pyramid investment schemes will get their money back.
I think so. The new government can find the money because 50% to all the money, I think, is here in Albania. And the other 50%, I think, is around Albania.
But if they don't get their money back, what then?
I think the new government can find the route to give back all the money. And I hope so.
Some normality is returning to Vlora, but this is a place that has undergone turmoil in recent weeks. And the restoration of law and order, so necessary for any aid operation, still seems some way off.
Peter Biles in Vlora. The Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has said he's ready for direct talks with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in order to revive the peace process. These more conciliatory remarks were made during his visit to the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo, from where our correspondent Flora Botsford now reports.
Yasser Arafat, talking to journalists at the end of a two-day official visit to Sri Lanka, said he was ready for talks with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, so long as the Israeli leader was also ready for peace. Responding to demands by the American State Department that Mr. Arafat should do more to prevent attacks by Hamas, he said anyone acting against the law would face tough action, Hamas militants included. He said Israel was facing instability and confrontation because it was not intending to implement the peace accords honestly and accurately. But he would not accept civil war. He was still committed to the peace process. There's increasing concern in Washington that Mr. Arafat has loosened his grip on Hamas. The Israeli government is also demanding the Palestinians do more to improve the security situation before talks can resume. Mr. Arafat received a warm welcome in Sri Lanka, where the government recognized the State of Palestine in 1988, and officials addressed the Palestinian leader as Your Excellency the President. Sri Lanka has no diplomatic relations with Israel.
Flora Botsford reporting. And here on Newsday in a moment, we'll be going to Hollywood and the Oscar Awards. English Patient is the movie title on everyone's lips. The main news headline, the Prime Minister of Zaire has submitted his resignation to President Mobutu as rebel forces accelerate their advance across the southeast of the country. Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, Sir Julius Chan, faces a critical 24 hours. A motion in Parliament today could force him to resign on the issue of the $36 million contract with a company called Sandline for hired foreign mercenaries to crush a rebellion on Bougainville Island. The army is now demanding his resignation, and several ministers have, or say they're going to, resign in protest at the mercenary plan. David Mai, the agriculture minister, is one who's gone, and he explained why.
I resigned simply to uphold the constitution of my country. You see, three of our colleagues, the Prime Minister, his deputy, and the Defense Minister, decided to enter into a contractual agreement with a company called Sandline outside of cabinet. And I thought that was not proper. And also, the manner in which it was handled was not proper.
So is your objective in resigning to apply more pressure on the Prime Minister?
Yes. My objective in resigning is in line with the public perception here, right here in Papua New Guinea, that just about everybody in this country is feels that what was done in the dealing with the Sandline was outside the legal parameters of this country, and therefore they pressurized the three gentlemen involved to step down, and I thought my stepping down would also play a part in forcing these three gentlemen to step down.
And do you think they will go today?
I am not sure, but I have a very strong feeling that they will.
And in that case, who would you like to see as Prime Minister instead?
We have in the government camp the former Prime Minister, say Rabbi Namalu, who is now Speaker. He is available. And another gentleman, the Deputy Leader of the PPP, say Albert Kipalan. These two very senior gentlemen are available. And I will be quite happy to see one of them taking the reins.
David Mai, the Agriculture Minister. And a short while ago, I contacted Lucy Palmer of the Sydney Morning Herald, who's in the capital, Port Moresby, at the Parliament, where the debate on the opposition censure motion is underway. What is the nature of the resolution which Sir Julian Chan faces?
Well, the nature of it is to call for his resignation, at least for him to stand down while the Commission of Inquiry is proceeding. But I have to say that the debate so far has been very much centred on divisions within the opposition and calls for the government not to be held by the army at gunpoint and forced to resign. So although it seems as though the government still has the numbers to reject the motion, things are very fluid and it seems as though the opposition's motion is not coming up terribly strongly so far.
Is this opposition motion binding?
It's not binding, and in fact the opposition recognise that and concede that themselves, but what they're looking for is to try and place Sir Julius under greater internal pressure, not only from the opposition, but from his own political allies in the government. And so he is not bound by it, but I think that they were under a certain amount of moral and political pressure.
But unless the opposition can pull together, then the chances of him going are much less, presumably.
Yes, they are. At the moment, the government has the numbers. The motion needs 56 votes to carry, and it looks as though the government has 63. Having said that, some of the government ministers have indicated privately that they are considering walking to the other side of the floor when the vote is called. So it's still a very fluid situation.
But if the one issue in the middle of all this is whether or not Sir Julius Chan should be forced to step down, what are the points which are dividing the opposition?
Well, as I said before, the point which is really dividing the opposition in debate at the moment is whether it's fair that the government should, or the Prime Minister should, stand down simply because the army tells him that he should. But really, that's not the issue of the day. The fact is, the government, particularly the Prime Minister, has consistently lied to the nation over the nature of the Sandline international contract. However, that particular point has not been raised effectively by the opposition. The opposition, like the government, is a loose coalition of parties, and they are simply not organised enough. And at the moment, not even the opposition leader has been able to speak yet because of various motions on the floor. So the opposition, if they want to push this through, they really need to take a long, deep breath and work out their strategy for this afternoon.
Lucy Palmer in Port Moresby. The Australian Upper House of Parliament has voted to reject the law which Northern Territory passed last year, allowing terminally ill people to commit suicide. The legislation, the first of its kind in the world, provoked global condemnation from religious leaders and doctors. And now, federal MPs and senators have stepped in to overrule the Territory Parliament. Martin Stott reports from Australia.
The parliamentary debate went on into the early hours as senators argued whether to pass the Kevin Andrews Bill, a private member's bill, which argued the federal parliament had the power and the moral right to overturn the controversial euthanasia law introduced last year by the Northern Territory Parliament. Shane Stone, the Northern Territory's chief minister, was clearly upset as the result came in.
Well, that's just one of the most devastating things that has ever happened in the history of the Territory. It, regardless of your views on euthanasia, regardless of whether you support it or you oppose it, the fact that another parliament in another place has basically stomped on Territorians, and there will be a lot of people for a very long time that will be very unforgiving of that having occurred.
So far, four people, all dying from cancer, have used the Northern Territory legislation to end their lives. They were helped by Dr. Philip Nitschke, who has two more terminally ill patients who've met the law's requirements and wish to end their lives when they're ready to die. An angry Dr. Nitschke burnt a copy of the Andrews Bill outside Parliament.
I'll show the contempt for the Andrews Bill that the Senate has shown to my patients by setting fire to it. And I'll show them do the same thing to the Northern Territory Self-Government Act, because that is the waste of the paper that it's printed on.
What's your reaction, Dr. Nitschke?
Never seen such a disgusting performance. The Senate of Australia betrayed the terminally ill in Australia. They betrayed especially the two people that are dying in the Territory tonight. It was a disgusting, pathetic betrayal.
Some senators had argued that Dr. Nitschke's two terminally ill patients should be exempt from the change in law so as not to have to end their lives prematurely.
How could we say, you can't make that decision, we are voting to end your option to end your own suffering, we are voting that you must suffer as you do not want to. The indignity, the pain, the unacceptability of your dying days.
I think there is a high probability that they may choose, even by 1 minute, to advance the time of their death. And that's something that I can assure you, whatever my views, I am not comfortable about at all. And I certainly don't want to walk out of here tonight knowing that two people will kill themselves tomorrow as a result of the Senate vote.
But that amendment was rejected. The Andrews Bill doesn't become law till it's signed by the Governor-General. That could be within a couple of days. Dr. Nitschke's patients now have the dilemma as to whether to end their lives immediately or wait till it's too late, in which case he'd have to break the law to help them die.
Martin Stott reporting.
The Oscar goes to Walter Murch, Mark Berger, David Parker, and Chris Newman for The English Patient.
Gabriel Yared for The English Patient.
Walter Murch for The English Patient.
John Seal for The English Patient.
And Oscar goes to Anthony Minghella for The English Patient.
And the Oscar goes to The English Patient, Saul Zant.
The English Patient, you may have gathered from that, did reasonably well at this year's Oscar Awards. In fact, it won 9 in all on a day which had a slightly unreal air about it, in part because so few of the winners came from the ranks of traditional stars. We're going now to Los Angeles and Steve Futterman. Steve, The English Patient, it seems pretty well swept all before it.
Yeah, let me come up with a metaphor. Hollywood has given The English Patient a very clean bill of health, indeed. 9 Academy Awards. Let me put this in historical perspective. Ben-Hur, Ben-Hur, a movie from the early 60s, late 50s, I believe, even before I started covering Academy Awards. It has won the most Oscars, 11. West Side Story won 10. After that comes Gigi, The Last Emperor, and now The English Patient with 9. So it's tied for the third most number of Oscars won by any film. Quite an achievement for this film.
I know it was expected to do pretty well, but as well as this?
I don't think quite as well as this. I think most people thought 7, maybe 8. It was expected to be the dominant film. It was expected to be the film that won Best Picture of the Year. It wasn't expected, though, to do this well. The big surprise came in the Best Supporting Actress category. Juliette Binoche, who did awfully well in The English Patient, was not expected to win, but she did win it. Lauren Bacall was the woman most people thought was going to win, because she had never even won an Oscar before for sort of her lifetime achievement in movies and film. But she did not win, and Juliette Binoche was the surprise winner. She becomes, by the way, French actress ever to win an Academy Award.
And what's happened then, Steve, to the traditional dominance of Hollywood studios and Hollywood stars?
I think we're seeing maybe a new era of stars. I think people like Juliette Binoche are going to be heard from for a long time. Jeffrey Rush, first Australian to win Best Actor. He is a name we're going to hear from in the years ahead. He won the Oscar for Best Actor for his moving portrayal of a tormented concert pianist in Shine. We also had Frances McDormand, a relatively new American actress. She won for Fargo. I think we're seeing a new group of actors taking center stage. And although they seem new now, I don't think 5-10 years from now we'll see these names and say, well, who are these people? I think we will know who these people are.
So the Oscar awards do give any career, even if it is going pretty well, an enormous boost.
Oh, yes. There's a line, Cuba Gooding Jr., by the way, he won the Oscar for Jerry Maguire. He came up with the famous line in Jerry Maguire, "Show me the money." Well, if you win an Oscar, you are going to see lots of money. It does anything you want it to do. It doesn't guarantee you stardom, but it guarantees you're going to get more money next time. If you're a director, if you're part of the profit-sharing process, your film's going to do much better. People are going to start seeing it a bit more. Video rentals will go up. An Oscar does nothing but good for a film.
And Hollywood's had a good night out as usual, I guess.
Oh, yeah, the parties have already started. The Academy puts on its own party here at the Shrine Auditorium. You may hear some noise in the background. I'm still in the press room here. It's called the Governor's Ball. It's sort of a boring party, but people go to that party first, and then they go to the party they really want to go to, and there are like 10 or 12 really big parties here in Southern California tonight. Elton John has one of the big parties every year, to mention one of them.
Now, Steve, a chance here in brief for you to show off. You said that Juliette Binoche was only the third French actress. Very briefly, who were the other two to win that award?
Don't you know? Of course, Claudette Colbert and Simone Signoret.
He's got all the answers, that boy. Steve Futterman in Los Angeles, many thanks. And in closing, a look at the main news headlines. The Prime Minister of Zaire has submitted his resignation to President Mobutu as rebel forces accelerate their advance across the southeast of the country. And a look, too, at what's been happening on the markets. And the Dow Jones closed up 101 points at 69.05. In Tokyo, the Nikkei has closed up 395 at 18.439, and the dollar 123.4 yen and 1 German mark 68.8. I'm Oliver Scott. This was Newsday.
This is London.
Oh, 7 hours, Greenwich Mean Time. BBC World Service, the news with John Stone. The army in Papua New Guinea has stepped up action to force the resignation of the country's prime minister, with armed soldiers joining crowds of protesters outside the parliament building. The Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has said he's ready to meet the Israeli prime minister for peace talks. The United States Vice President Al Gore, who's in Beijing, has witnessed the signing of multi-million dollar deals between China and American companies. The annual Oscars ceremony in Los Angeles has seen the British film, The English Patient, sweep the board with 9 awards. The armed forces in Papua New Guinea have begun a concerted effort to force the resignation of the country's Prime Minister, Sir Julius Chan. As Parliament met in the capital, Port Moresby, to consider a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister, armed soldiers orchestrated anti-government protests by thousands of people outside the building. Earlier, the Commonwealth Secretary-General, Chief Emeka Anyoko, held talks with senior army commanders to try to defuse the mounting political crisis over their opposition to the hiring of foreign mercenaries by the Prime Minister. Reporting from Papua New Guinea is Jonathan Birchall.
A political crisis in Papua New Guinea sparked by a bid to deploy foreign mercenaries has now taken a turn for the worse, with the army launching an orchestrated attempt to intimidate a sitting of the country's parliament. The MPs are discussing a call for the Prime Minister, Sir Julius Chan, to resign over the hiring of South African mercenaries organised by a British private security company, Sandline International. But as the debate got underway, armed soldiers could be seen directing busloads of protesters to the area around Parliament, some of them chanting, people power, as they marched. Soldiers manning one checkpoint claimed that no one was in command and that they were acting independently. Police have now given way to the soldiers on the streets around Parliament. They say that there are more troops around the Parliament building itself, along with several hundred more rowdy protesters bussed in by the military. The army made their move despite growing political pressure for the Prime Minister to step down, and despite a mediation bid by the Commonwealth Secretary General, Chief Anyoko. He had earlier said that it was important for the whole Commonwealth for the situation here to be resolved in a constitutional manner. Instead, Papua New Guinea is facing a bid by the military to drive the Prime Minister from power.
Ecuador's Environment Minister, Flor de Maria Valverde, has called on the military to intervene to help stop the illegal gathering of shellfish in the Galapagos Islands in the Pacific Ocean. The call is being backed by wildlife protection groups following violent incidents last week. In one, a local official was shot and wounded by fishermen as he tried to close down an illegal processing plant. The minister said stricter laws were needed to ensure the protection of the islands, which are well known for their unique ecosystem. The Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has said he's ready to hold talks with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to try to resolve the latest setbacks in the Middle East peace process. Mr. Arafat, who's visiting Sri Lanka, said he was ready to meet the Israeli leader to find an end to the recent outbreak of violence, but not if the meeting was for propaganda purposes. Our correspondent in Colombo is Flora Botsford.
Yasser Arafat, talking to journalists at the end of a two-day official visit to Sri Lanka, said he was ready for talks with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu so long as the Israeli leader was also ready for peace. Responding to demands by the American State Department that Mr. Arafat should do more to prevent attacks by Hamas, he said anyone acting against the law would face tough action, Hamas militants included. He said Israel was facing instability and confrontation because it was not intending to implement the peace accords honestly and accurately. But he would not accept civil war. He was still committed to the peace process. There's increasing concern in Washington that Mr. Arafat has loosened his grip on Hamas. The Israeli government is also demanding the Palestinians do more to improve the security situation before talks can resume. Mr. Arafat received a warm welcome in Sri Lanka, where the government recognized the State of Palestine in 1988, and officials addressed the Palestinian leader as Your Excellency the President. Sri Lanka has no diplomatic relations with Israel.
Federal investigators in the United States say they may be close to a breakthrough in their investigation into the bombing at an American base in Saudi Arabia 9 months ago. They believe a Saudi national arrested in Canada last week, Hani Abdulrahmin Sayegh, may have been the driver of one of the vehicles used in the bombing, in which 19 Americans were killed, and they want to question him. The suspect, thought to be a Shiite Muslim, has denied any involvement, saying he has stamps on his passport that prove he was in Syria at the time. The Zairean Prime Minister, Kengo Wadondo, has bowed to political pressure and handed in his resignation to President Mobutu, who is reported to have asked him to stay in office until a successor is named. Mr. Kengo, who's been criticized for his handling of the war against the rebels, had resisted previous moves by members of parliament to force his resignation. As rebel forces accelerate their advance in eastern Zaire, A BBC correspondent in Kinshasa says the new government's main task will be to negotiate a ceasefire and halt the rebel advance. Government troops have started pulling out of two towns in eastern Zaire. Security sources believe the troops are being withdrawn to reinforce the capital, Kinshasa. Talks are due to begin today between African leaders in the Togolese capital Lomé, aimed at finding a solution to the crisis in Zaire. Foreign ministers from African states will be holding a day of talks before the summit of heads of state on Wednesday. The United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is expected to attend and has expressed optimism that the talks will lead to a negotiated settlement of the conflict in Zaire. This news comes to you in the World Service of the BBC. The American Vice President Al Gore has begun talks with the Chinese Prime Minister Li Peng on the second day of his visit to Beijing. China signed deals with two American firms, under which it will buy five huge passenger jets from the Boeing Corporation and launch a joint car-making venture with General Motors. Mr. Gore's the most senior American politician to visit China since the suppression of the pro-democracy movement 8 years ago. From Beijing, here's Carrie Gracie.
The American Vice President and Chinese Prime Minister presided together today over the signing of two deals, one in which China's international carrier Air China agreed to buy passenger jets worth almost $700 million from the Boeing Corporation, the other in which General Motors agreed to enter a joint venture worth $1.3 billion with a Shanghai plant to build medium-sized cars in China. In both cases, negotiations had been held up since 1995, by the chill in U.S.-China relations, which was caused by differences over Taiwan. China pointedly bought a new fleet of European Airbuses and cold-shouldered top American companies like Boeing. So officials traveling with Mr. Gore told journalists that today's agreements were proof of greater economic cooperation between the United States and China. And Beijing will point to the Boeing purchase as evidence that China is doing its best to even up a trade balance, which is currently $40 billion in its favor.
South Korean security officials say three North Koreans have escaped to Hong Kong in an effort to defect to South Korea. They're said to be the mother and two brothers of a 28-year-old man who defected to the South last year. Italy and Albania have reached agreement on an Italian naval blockade in the Adriatic Sea to try to prevent the further migration of Albanians to southern Italy. The new agreement was announced in Rome after several hours of talks between the Italian Prime Minister, Romano Prodi, and Albania's new Prime Minister, Bashkim Fino. Mr. Fino is currently in Rome, where he's due to meet European Union foreign ministers, who are there to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome, which founded the European Economic Community. It's from Rome that David Eads reports.
The presence of Bashkim Fino on a day earmarked as one of celebration of the European Union's achievements adds an uncomfortable air to this 40th anniversary. The foreign ministers have struggled to draw up a coherent approach to the violence and loss of order in Albania, and it's still unclear how willing countries will be to provide military escorts for relief workers. But Mr. Fino's presence may help the ministers to focus on the other task in hand, the review of the Maastricht Treaty on closer European Union. Europe's weak record in foreign policy has prompted calls from some countries for a more flexible decision-making system. France and Germany, backed by four other countries, are pushing hard to establish a greater defence role too for the EU. And there are plans which would enable some countries to pursue closer integration ahead of the rest. Countries like Britain seem keen to hold out against most of these changes.
As the European Union considers what humanitarian operation it can mount in Albania, the Albanian president, Salih Berisha, has said he cannot guarantee the safety of aid convoys. In an interview with a British newspaper, Mr. Berisha said that looting and banditry would be a major hazard. Correspondents say that with the exception of the capital, Tirana, and parts of the north still loyal to President Berisha, few police and army officers remain under government command, and there are continuing reports of lawlessness and crime. The Bosnian president, Alija Izetbegovic, says the United States has failed to complete the training and arming of his country's military forces as agreed and has urged them to speed up the process. At a meeting in Washington with the American Defense Secretary, William Cohen, Mr. Izetbegovic said that so far only 20% of the program has been implemented. Washington says the program is on schedule. Courts in three American states have ruled against an attempt by major tobacco companies to prevent disclosure of potentially damaging internal documents. The papers belong to a tobacco company, Liggett, which last week became the first cigarette manufacturer to admit that smoking is addictive and causes cancer. The documents are wanted by attorneys general in 22 American states, which are suing cigarette manufacturers to recoup the cost of smoking-related health care. The courts will now decide whether the papers can be used as evidence. A British film, The English Patient, has triumphed at the 69th Annual Academy Awards Ceremony in Los Angeles, in what was generally a good year for independent and international filmmakers. The English Patient, an epic wartime romance, won the Oscar for Best Picture and 8 other awards, including Best Director for Anthony Minghella, making it the most successful British film in the history of the Oscars. A Czech film won the award for Best Foreign Picture. Clive Murray was in Hollywood to watch the Oscars ceremony.
It's estimated around 1 billion people watched the Oscars ceremony live on television around the world. The awards honour the best of world cinema, with the British film The English Patient winning the most prizes, 9 in all, including the Oscar for Best Picture. Its director and writer, Anthony Minghella, had enormous difficulty financing the film and at one stage had to shut down production in Rome when the money ran out. The film's producer, Saul Zients, paid tribute to all those who stayed with the project.
When we were shut down, ran out of money, everyone stayed there in Italy without pay, and we had no money to pay him. Thank you all.
Five films from the Czech Republic, France, Norway, Georgia, and Russia were nominated in the Best Foreign Language Film category. The winner was Jan Sverek from the Czech Republic for Collier. Big Hollywood studio films were conspicuous by their absence from the Oscars awards ceremony. Of the five films nominated for Best Picture, only one, Jerry Maguire, starring Tom Cruise, was made by a large studio. The others are all independent films made with relatively modest amounts of money. The feeling here is that while Hollywood is good at churning out blockbusters that can make millions of dollars around the world, the ability seems to have been lost of making critically acclaimed as well as commercially successful movies.
To end the news, here are the main points again. The armed forces in Papua New Guinea are stepping up their pressure on the Prime Minister Sir Julius Chan to resign. Armed soldiers have joined demonstrators in a protest outside the Parliament building in Port Moresby. The Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has said he's ready to meet the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about the crisis in the peace talks. Mr. Arafat said strong action would be taken against anyone breaking the law, including members of the militant Hamas group. The American Vice President Al Gore has witnessed the signing of big trade deals during talks in China with the Prime Minister Li Peng. Mr. Gore's the most senior American politician to visit China since the violent suppression of the pro-democracy movement. That's the end of the news from London.